Hey, future doctors, welcome back to Spoonful of Sugar. Please welcome our host, Verity Lee, a medical student at Drexel College of Medicine. She will be discussing all things related to medical ethics, legal topics, and professionalism. Don't be fooled, this topic is increasingly high yield on the USMLE exams.
Hey, future doctors. Thanks for tuning in to Spoonful of Sugar, a podcast made for medical students by medical students to help the medicine go down. My name is Verity Lee, and I'm in M3 at Drexel's College of Medicine, and I will be your host today. Today, I'm going to provide an overview of high-yield ethical concepts you need to know for step one. Throughout this episode, I'll be asking questions so you can revisit this episode later and test yourself. Feel free to pause during these questions if you need to take time to think about the answer. Remember, this podcast is just another tool to help you prepare, so use it in whatever way works best for you. Let's start with the principles of medical ethics that should guide every decision. What are the four principles of medical ethics? The four principles of medical ethics are autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and justice. Patient autonomy emphasizes respect for a patient's right to make informed decisions about their health care. Scenarios typically involve informed consent or treatment refusal. Next, beneficence focuses on acting in the patient's best interest, such as recommending treatments that maximize benefit. Non-maleficence is the principle of do no harm, which involves avoiding unnecessary risks or procedures unless the benefits outweigh the harm. Lastly, justice ensures fairness in healthcare delivery, for example, when allocating limited resources like organ transplants. Keep these principles in mind as we go through this episode. Next, I want to talk about informed consent. Informed consent is the cornerstone of ethical practice. Key features include explaining the nature of the procedure, discussing its risks and benefits, outlining alternatives, and providing opportunities for questions. To have decision-making capacity, the patient must be able to understand, evaluate, and communicate their choices. Exceptions to informed consent include emergency situations, waived consent by the patient, or rare cases where therapeutic privilege is invoked to prevent harm. Now, I want to ask you, what do we do if there is a language barrier between the physician and the patient? If language barriers exist, always use a certified interpreter. Do not rely on friends or family members, as this may not ensure accuracy and confidentiality. If the patient doesn't understand verbally, visuals can also be used to supplement understanding. Speaking of confidentiality, this is a fundamental part of patient care. Under HIPAA, patient information should never be shared with individuals not directly involved in care or in public spaces such as elevators where others could overhear. For example, if another physician in the hospital asks about a patient who happens to be their neighbor, you should neither confirm nor deny the patient's identity, explaining that sharing information is prohibited unless they are part of the care team. Patients must consent to any information sharing, even with their friends or family. Certain situations, however, require mandatory reporting. One situation being if the patient has suicidal ideation. The question for you here is, at what point is hospitalization necessary for a patient with suicidal ideation? If a patient expresses suicidal intent with a plan and means to carry it out, hospitalization is required. Voluntary admission is preferred, but involuntary admission may be necessary if the patient is uncooperative and there is evidence of immediate danger to themselves or others. For the purposes of step one, I will emphasize the patient must have both intent and a concrete plan. Cases of abuse must also be reported. For child abuse cases, you may have a situation where a parent brings their child in with bruising that doesn't align with the story given. For elder abuse, you may have a situation where you have an elderly patient that looks frail, unkempt, with poor hygiene. Sometimes they may also have signs of dehydration and bruises of varying stages of healing. Any red flag signs of non-accidental trauma should always point your attention to abuse. Child abuse must be reported to Child Protective Services and elder abuse to Adult Protective Services. Other mandatory reporting situations include infectious diseases that pose a public health risk and injuries such as gunshot wounds. Intimate partner violence, on the other hand, may not always be subject to mandatory reporting. When handling intimate partner violence, it is crucial to recognize the signs, assess the situation, and take appropriate actions. Signs of intimate partner violence may include physical injuries inconsistent with the patient's explanation, frequent visits with vague complaints, and psychological symptoms such as anxiety, depression, or withdrawal. Controlling or dominating behavior by a patient can also be a red flag. During assessment, it is essential to screen the patient privately and use open-ended, non-judgmental questions like, "Do you feel safe at home?" Additionally, evaluate the patient's safety and risk of immediate or further harm. For the purposes of step one, the most important thing to remember is to empower the patient to make their own decisions rather than pressuring them to leave the relationship, as they may prefer to not have law enforcement called. It is also necessary to engage the patient in safety planning. A personalized safety plan should be developed, identifying safe exits, places to go, and trusted individuals the patient can contact for help. It is important to provide resources such as hotline numbers, shelters, and community services. Patients should also be encouraged to gather essential items, including IDs, money, medications, and legal documents, and keep them easily accessible for emergencies. It is also important to avoid confronting the abusive partner directly or providing written materials that could be discovered. Maintaining confidentiality unless reporting is mandated and respecting the patient's autonomy while ensuring they have access to resources is key to handling these situations on step one. Additionally, certain aspects of teen health care are also not subject to mandatory reporting to encourage adolescents to seek necessary care. This includes services related to sexual and reproductive health, such as testing and treatment for STIs, access to contraception and counseling, and pregnancy-related care, including prenatal care and, where legally permitted, abortion. Confidentiality also extends to mental health services unless the teen poses a threat to themselves or others, such as in cases of suicidal or homicidal ideation. Confidential treatment for substance abuse and addiction is also often allowed under state law. Now let's pivot and talk about advance directives. Advance directives are legal documents that allow individuals to specify their preferences for medical care if they become unable to make decisions for themselves. When discussing advance directives, patients may have living wills or a durable power of attorney to specify their wishes. If these aren't available, the next of kin may be involved. What is the hierarchy for next of kin? So the patient's spouse takes priority in medical decisions, then adult children, parents, and then siblings. If a patient's wishes are unknown, the physician should make medical decisions that are in the patient's best interest rather than based on external factors. When dealing with the end-of-life situations, it's important to also keep in mind, no matter how dire the situation is, try not to take away the patient's hope. Hope can take many forms, one being religion. Religion plays an important role in ethical care. For instance, patients have the right to practice their beliefs like prayer as long as it doesn't interfere with medical care or pose harm to themselves or others. Understanding and respecting cultural and spiritual needs is integral to care, and allowing the patient to practice their religion is often harmless and can provide emotional comfort, potentially benefiting the patient's well-being. But what do you do when religious beliefs do impact the patient's treatment plan, such as for Jehovah's Witnesses? In emergencies, Jehovah's Witnesses may refuse blood transfusions for themselves, but are not allowed to deny blood transfusions to their children. In general, any parent cannot refuse life-saving treatments for their children if it places a child's life at risk. Now, let's talk about what happens when the physician makes a mistake, as we're all human and mistakes are inevitable. What are the 8 types of medical errors? The 8 types of medical errors are diagnostic errors, including overdiagnosing, missed or delayed diagnoses, and incorrect diagnoses, treatment errors, preventative errors, which are related to preventative care, communication errors, system errors, administrative errors, adverse events, or unintended harm caused by medical care, not necessarily due to the error, and near misses, or events that could have caused harm but didn't due to chance or timely intervention. When discussing malpractice and medical errors, transparency is critical and errors should be acknowledged right away. Never lie or redirect blame. Many physicians may be fearful that admitting mistakes can lead to malpractice lawsuits, but studies show that being transparent with patients immediately after the discovery of the error is actually appreciated by patients, and most don't move forward with lawsuits. When communicating these errors with patients, you want to use empathy and honesty. Acknowledge the mistake without being defensive and apologize sincerely, then explain what happened. Next steps also include notifying the hospital's risk management or patient safety department and participating in a root cause analysis to prevent future mistakes. Knowing how to approach patient interactions is key to these step one questions. Let's talk about motivational interviewing, a patient-centered approach to guide behavior change, such as smoking or medical non-adherence. What are the core principles of motivational interviewing? The core principles include expressing empathy, developing discrepancy between current behaviors and goals, rolling with resistance, and supporting self-efficacy. You want to first build rapport by understanding the patient's perspective without judgment. Next, you want to help the patient see the gap between their current behavior and their goals or values. Then, if they are resistant to change, acknowledge their resistance and reframe it to explore the patient's perspective. One thing to keep in mind is do not confront or pressure the patient if they are not ready to make a change yet in terms of lifestyle habits or addiction. Lastly, you want to empower the patient to believe in their ability to change. Now let's circle back to medical and medication at non-adherence, as those are also common challenges. Patients may face barriers such as high costs, fear of side effects, or a lack of understanding about their condition. To improve adherence, identify the patient's challenges or any existing barriers, simplify regimens, provide education, and use tools like alarms or pill organizers. Do not make assumptions or blame the patient. Keep in mind, it is also unnecessary to change the treatment plan based on a single instance of non-compliance. Additionally, let's touch on vaccine hesitancy. Hesitancy may stem from misinformation, cultural beliefs, distrust in the healthcare system, or fear of side effects. As physicians, we need to build trust with patients, provide evidence-based education, and address their concerns empathetically to encourage vaccination. As we build trust with patients, patients may also try to give gifts. When it comes to gift giving, maintain professional boundaries. Small symbolic gifts like homemade food are generally acceptable, but large or extravagant gifts should be declined to avoid conflicts of interest. If you're unsure, it is best to express gratitude to the patient and respectfully explain hospital policies. Finally, just for good measure, although it's not the most high yield, I want to talk a little bit about insurance. Health insurance serves as a way to share risk among individuals and provide access to healthcare services with financial protection. Some key terms to know include premiums and deductibles. Premiums are regular payments to maintain coverage, and deductibles are out-of-pocket payments required before insurance coverage begins. Patients may also encounter co-payments or co-insurance, which are cost-sharing mechanisms where the patient pays part of the service cost. Most insurance plans set an out-of-pocket maximum, which is the maximum amount a patient must pay in a year before insurance covers 100% of the costs. There are different types of health insurance. Private insurance is often provided through employers or purchased individually. On the other hand, public insurance refers to government-funded programs, though these aren't traditional insurance plans. Medicare serves individuals aged 65 and older, those with disabilities, and individuals with end-stage renal disease. It is divided into four parts. Part A is for hospital coverage, Part B is for outpatient services, Part C is Medicare Advantage, and Part D is for prescription drugs. Medicaid is a program jointly funded by federal and state governments that provides coverage for low-income individuals and families. The Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, covers healthcare costs for children and families that earn too much to qualify for Medicaid but cannot afford private insurance. There are also various private insurance plans available. A health maintenance organization, or HMO, requires patients to use a network of providers and obtain referrals to see specialists, with no coverage for out-of-network services except in emergencies. A preferred provider organization, or PPO, offers more flexibility in choosing providers, as patients do not need to see a primary care physician or PCP before seeing a specialist. PPOs tend to have higher premiums or monthly payments because they provide partial coverage for out-of-network services. and patients usually face higher out-of-pocket costs when using out-of-network providers. A point of service, or POS plan, is a hybrid of HMO and PPO, requiring referrals for specialists and offering limited out-of-network coverage, often with higher out-of-pocket costs. In contrast, a fee-for-service plan pays providers separately for each service, leading to itemized billing. Finally, an exclusive provider organization, or EPO, does not require a PCP referral for specialists, but does not cover out-of-network visits except in emergencies. While plans with restricted networks can initially have lower premiums than PPOs, their lack of out-of-network coverage can result in significant costs if specialized or unexpected care is needed, such as if the patient develops a new chronic medical illness. To remember these insurance types, here are some mnemonics that might be helpful. HMO can be remembered as stay home or in-network, and the P in PPO as any place, as it's not restricted to within a network. Additionally, Medicare can be associated with care for the elderly and disabled, while Medicaid reminds us to aid the pregnant and the poor. As a final tip, when answering these ethical questions on step one, remember to always listen to the patient's perspective and let them guide the conversation. It's important to take the time to fully grasp their values and goals before providing advice because every patient is different. Always start the conversation by first gauging their understanding of the situation. It's very natural to want to jump right in and give advice, but as physicians, we have to try to get a full understanding of the patient's perspective and understanding of the situation before giving our medical advice. Finally, consider answer choices that use open-ended questions, provide affirmations, show reflective listening, and effective summarization. By doing so, you'll demonstrate respect and empathy, which are crucial in ethical patient care. Congratulations! You've made it to the end of this podcast episode. Thank you for listening, and good luck on step one. You've got this.